Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
You are listening to Missed Apex Podcast. We live F1. Welcome to Missed Apex Podcast, brought to you today by summersf1.co.uk, making F1 tech easier to understand. I'm your host, Matt Trumpets. Today's episode is called Pickup Sticks, and our guest today is none other than Mr. Matthew Summerfield himself, the hardest working man in tech F1. Summers, great to have you back. How are things?
Things are excellent for me, Matt, and I hope they're just as good for you, especially as you have a E-Pri in your backyard this weekend.
Oh, yes. You know, thanks to your very clever fingers and hands, I was able to wrangle myself some official press accreditation to the event, and I've been busy getting sunburned, trying to find out every last thing that's going on down there. But I need to remind everyone, we are an independent podcast supported by you, the listener. We aim to bring you a race review before your Monday morning commute. We might be wrong, but we're first. The show is safe for work. We're keeping it clean so you can play this with the kids in the background or at work. If you want to join the live stream, find Missed Apex Podcast on YouTube and subscribe. Click the little bell icon when you subscribe and you'll get a notification when we go live. So today we have a bit of a thing going on. We're looking at developments, and there have been many developments over the last 3 weeks. So without any further ado, how about we get right to it? So I think where I'd like to start is with the last race we just had at Silverstone. All of a sudden, I start seeing in the press everywhere that the Ferrari engine is now more powerful than the Mercedes engine. Can this be true? What is going on there?
Well, I think we've kind of got to a stage in the development program where Ferrari appear to have taken a bit of an advancement on Mercedes. But I think that's skewed by the way in which that both are representing reliability over performance. So we have to factor in the fact that obviously for this year that we only have 3 power units, which is obviously split down into 3 internal combustion engines, 3 turbos, and 3 MGUHs, and then 2 of the other components. And obviously at some point, some of the other manufacturers are going to take penalties, as we've already seen with Honda, and we're expecting to see with Renault. But for me, it seems that Ferrari are kind of expecting to take that pain as well at some point, just based on the fact that they've skewed more towards performance. So they have to have less reliability over a shorter period of time. So obviously it gives them a slight offset to Mercedes, who seem to have gone down the route of saying, well, we'll hold back some performance in order that we don't have to take the pain of penalties. Now, obviously that obviously plays into the issue of when we look at when these penalties will potentially be taken as well, which will be towards the end of the season. And I think perhaps Ferrari are thinking that it's not so much of a problem. We have to look at Silverstone and Hamilton, for argument's sake, and the way that he pressed his way back through the field. If Ferrari do have to take penalties, and grid penalties is what I'm talking about here, then perhaps it might not be such a bad thing anyway. So perhaps it's worth taking that pain to get the extra performance in the leading part of the championship.
So you're suggesting, if I'm understanding you correctly, that Ferrari will take an extra power unit at a strategic location where the kind of work we saw Hamilton do would be possible for their drivers.
Yeah, I think that they've kind of come to the realization that doing 21 races on 3 power units is a bridge too far if you want full blown performance. And so to account for that, they're thinking, well, we'll take a pain at some point and take an extra power unit into our allocation. I'm not saying that they can't make the distance. I'm just saying that in the back of their mind, they may be thinking that, you know, we're going for performance. We want the performance at the times when we need it. Certainly at places like Silverstone, where they're running the engine completely flat out. They obviously, like Mercedes, trimmed out for places like Silverstone. But, you know, you can see that power advantage when you look at the next best team, Red Bull, who really struggled against Ferrari and Mercedes in Silverstone.
Yeah, and it did seem that Red Bull has suddenly... I don't know if you want to get into it right this second, but it seems that suddenly Red Bull has left the top tier of performance in this last race. Is this just something we're going to see with them at racetracks that are like Silverstone? And is it just down to the Renault power unit that's not got enough grunt for the aerodynamics they want to run?
Yes. I mean, Red Bull have for the last couple of seasons had to take the pain of trimming their car in order to reduce drag so that they can overcome their power unit deficit to the bigger two teams. And as those teams continue to press on and use more performance to fight one another, inevitably you're going to see this gap appear with Red Bull. We're also in a situation where Ferrari and Mercedes seem to have extended their gap to Renault, even though they now apparently have the party mode. But the problem with something like a party mode is you're taking performance from the matrix of performance over a long period of time. So, you know, you want to take that extra performance in qualifying, you're going to have to take the pain in the race, because you can't have both performance and reliability. You know, they're kind of interlinked with one another. So I think we're starting to see you know, the difference between the philosophies of the three teams there, but clearly there's a difference or a disparity between what is on offer to Ferrari and Mercedes and what is on offer to Red Bull via Renault.
Yeah, and I guess that's going to be good news for Sauber, amongst others. But I thought I read somewhere, and maybe you can confirm this, that only the Renault Works team is actually running their new MGUK.
Yeah, that's correct. Although I believe Stoffel may have taken the new MGUK because he had to take a penalty anyway. I'd have to confirm that for definite. I believe it's just Alonso and the two Red Bull drivers. But obviously, if they take new MGUKs, they're already on their second of their allocation and they only get two for the season. So they put another one in the pool, they're taking a penalty for it.
All right, then. But I thought it was down to some packaging issues. Was I wrong about that?
Well, there may well be some packaging issues in terms of the way in which that Red Bull have actually applied the power unit to installation to their car, which means then obviously that, you know, Renault are going to have to continue to supply them with the old batch of MGUKs. But to be perfectly honest, this MGUK has been shelved for nearly 2 years, so I can't really see the type of performance increase that is going to make it a must have on the car. Certainly when you consider the fact that Red Bull are already ahead of the Renault Works team and the McLaren in any case. So I don't think it's a massive gain to be had from having the new MGUK in any respect. So yeah, I think they'll just continue to press on with the old specification.
Okay. Well, then let's talk a little bit about Mercedes then. So if I understand you correctly, if Mercedes was willing to be as risky as Ferrari, you still think basically those power units are on par?
I would suggest that they're very, very equal, yes. Everything and every Grand Prix brings new developments, because even though they may be running the same power unit at the next Grand Prix, obviously we know that Mercedes are running version 2.1, was originally scheduled to be run in Canada as version two. They had some supply issues. They needed to make changes. So that changed to version 2.1 for France. They continue to use that particular power unit. The biggest difference between these, the characteristics is, well, there's a couple of things. We have different fuels coming on, obviously. So that could change the development race in terms of you may have a fuel come on board that might give an advantage to one team over the other. And I would suggest that perhaps Ferrari are in that boat. We also have to remember that we're still sort of reeling from the oil burning controversy. So when these power unit modifications have happened, you know, the manufacturers are still trying to find performance in ways that they can still kind of create power from oil burning. And obviously we see that the Ferrari has a lot of vapor coming out the rear of it at every Grand Prix. So, you know, it's that is an area of development that he sort of had to go backwards before it can come back forwards. So it's where the particular engine manufacturer falls in that line. And then lastly, we've got the energy recovery system. I think that's perhaps where Ferrari might have found their biggest gains. We must remember that there's a lot of personnel transfer happened between the likes of Ferrari and Mercedes HPP in the last year or so. And I would suggest that more of those technical personnel have gone from Mercedes to Ferrari. And so in the way in which that they have been operating their energy recovery system might be something that Ferrari are really starting to capitalise on now. And it did appear to be that way in Silverstone. They just found a way to kind of find more electrical energy. And I know there's been this sort of hoo-ha over, are Ferrari making more electricity than is possible through their ERS? And obviously the FIA have found that hasn't been the case. I just think it's some more clever coding, because that's all it is at the end of the day. It's that harmonious relationship between the turbo MGU-H and MGU-K and the transfer of energy between those systems.
All right. Tell me about what's going on at Mercedes. Clearly, I think they were surprised by the result at Silverstone. I think they were surprised at Ferrari. And frankly, my personal opinion was that if Vettel had a trouble-free third practice, he could have actually walked away with pole. It was very, very close. Regardless of that, a week and a half later, suddenly it seems like half of Mercedes management is, moving on or moving up or moving over.
Yeah, so there's a few personnel shifts going on, and it's been something that's been in flux for a while. It's not happening overnight. It's just been announced by the team as this is what is happening now. So they have had safeguards put in place to move these people around and out of the system. The people that are actually going to be making way is Aldo Costa, for starters. He is the engineering director. And he's going into a consultancy role because being an Italian, being away from home, he wants to spend some more time with his family. John Owen, the chief designer, is going to absorb his duties. And then obviously we've got Mark Ellis, who's the performance director, who's actually retiring, but doesn't actually start his sabbatical until next summer. So his is more of a elongated transition. Which Loic Serra is going to take over some of his duties. But it's a difficult one with Mercedes because they operate with a very different system to the rest of the other teams. They have a lot of head of design areas. So to me, it's not too much of a problem for Mercedes. They should be able to cope with this sort of thing. They've got obviously James Allison sitting over the top of all of these different departments. I don't see it as too much of a problem, but it is going to have an effect on the way that everything is managed, obviously, because for argument's sake, I do things very differently to how you would do things, Matt. It's just the nature of the way in which people work. So, yeah, it will have some upset, but I do think that Mercedes can kind of absorb that issue.
Okay, so it's in other words, you're saying it's sort of a natural evolution of things at Mercedes and not a sign of impending drama or disaster.
No, it's just the natural course of the way in which that an operation has to change over time. People come and go, and so you have to make amendments to the way in which you're working in order to evolve with the current situation that you have at hand. But just going back to your point about Silverstone, I think the interesting thing about the way in which Ferrari approached Silverstone is that they wanted to be on par with Mercedes. And I think they threw quite a lot of performance towards that goal in terms of the way that they operated their power unit around Silverstone. So that perhaps they've took a bit of a kick in for reliability in that respect. But they also did some interesting things in terms of the way that they were operating their downforce package. So they run a quite low downforce package with a spoon rear wing. And they also had a new floor update. So I do think that there's quite a lot going on with Ferrari. They're working on iterational parts of their design. So they're building every single race upon the design envelope of that car. Whereas Mercedes are taking much larger arcs. For argument's sake, their side pods that they introduced in Austria was a massive development, something that would have been a huge undertaking. And it took a lot of development away from perhaps the smaller areas of the car that Ferrari have focused on this season. So they've got two very different philosophies about the way in which that they're approaching this season, I think.
So we might see Mercedes, once they get their large curve into place, then work backwards to find smaller gains from the newer developments that they've just put on the car?
Yeah, everybody works differently when it comes to this development game, you know, and it depends on the way in which you're looking at the car and the envelope of its operation. Obviously, Mercedes felt that the way in which that their side pod design worked was hindering them quite significantly, and they needed to make that alteration. But as I say, that would have absorbed quite a lot of R&D in order to resolve the problem. And as a consequence of that, some of their, what I would call, iterational designers perhaps had to be shelved in order to make that change. Whereas Ferrari haven't made huge changes, but they've continued to develop all areas of the car. We've had new front wings, we've had new turning vanes, new floor, barge boards, rear wing, etc. So, diffuser. So, you know, it's just very interesting the way in which we've got two very, very different cars that operate at the same sort of performance envelope. It's a fascinating battle there at the front.
It is. And I'm going to ask, is it just go back to the fundamentally different design characteristics of the two car? I mean, always Ferrari has been characterized as being less temperamental, easier to work with. And does it just sort of encourage, therefore, basically they got a very good design to start with, so it makes more sense to be iterational, whereas Mercedes had a design that could be either brilliant or catastrophic, and therefore they're looking at bigger pictures and thinking larger thoughts about how to bring it into that same sort of easy to deal with window that Ferrari seems to have placed themselves in.
Yeah, as you say, the last year's Ferrari and this year's Ferrari are very easy to work with in terms of setup and the way in which that they can perform at a variety of different circuits. Every circuit they go to, they seem to be able to get the best from that particular car. There's no real standout circuits for me where they've really struggled. Whereas Mercedes will go to for the likes of Monaco or Singapore, etc., where we're talking low speed corners, and they do struggle at those circuits. In fact, Mercedes took a modification to the side pods in Monaco that we've not seen since. They added some vortex generators atop the side pod in order to try to work the airflow much harder and obviously change the envelope in which the car works. So to me, that just highlighted that they had a little bit of an issue with the side pods already. And then obviously along came the new modification in Austria, which again centers around the power unit. You know, it's all of these things tie in together. And as I say, it's a very interesting developmental arc that we're seeing from the two teams in terms of the way that they're doing things very, very differently.
Yeah, it is interesting. And I'm wondering, while we're talking about development arcs, I know it's fun to sort of point your finger at Renault and laugh at how badly wrong they got it at the start, and sort of shake your head at how long they've taken to catch up. But is that, in your opinion, the only problem that Red Bull currently has?
It's the biggest factor, I would say. They're still struggling in terms of performance, which has an impact on their chassis. Because if Red Bull had a Mercedes, and it's easy to say this, but if Red Bull had a Mercedes or a Ferrari power unit in there, they could then alter the way in which their chassis works. They could load more downforce on, because they would be able to overcome the drag that inevitably comes with having more downforce. So, you know, they're always having to sacrifice chassis performance over power unit performance. So, yeah, in my eyes, it is mainly to do with the power unit. But obviously, they do have this side issue going on where they have to alter their chassis to account for that. Another interesting small topic that I've noticed with Red Bull comes down to their suspension setup. They started to use a hydraulic setup at the start of the season for the heave damper, much like Mercedes have been doing for several years. And over the last few races, they've been switching out between the hydraulic version and going back to the Belleville springs mounted on that damper. And I just find that interesting that, you know, they're having to try to find these small detail changes in order to try to get performance from the chassis, which, again, is a consequence of trying to chase the leading pair, which clearly have more power from their power units.
Well, I think you did say once that the faster the car goes, the better the car works. And clearly, if you look at the gaps this weekend, they're limited. But I had thought that Red Bull were the only team to actually keep their DRS open through turns one and two. Or was I mistaken about that?
I watched the last 10 laps of the race when Vettel was chasing, because he had the DRS pinned through turns one and two. He didn't lift out, which is bonkers, really, when you consider it. But it was down to fuel load, I think, primarily, because obviously you have a shift then on the pitch attitude of the car and also the dynamic ability of it. Obviously, Ericsson had an issue throughout the race where he binned it at that corner because he was on DRS and apparently hit a bump just before he thought he was closing it with the steering wheel. And unfortunately, instead of pressing it, he didn't. And the thing with when you go through that corner with DRS open, you use a different steering attitude to what you would do, or a different steering input to what you would do if you had DRS open or closed. And obviously, he used the DRS closed input and just chucked the car sideways. So, yeah. A difficult one for everybody to try to go through there. And I'm pleased, to be honest, that we've got this situation where DRS is being pushed to that direction, where it's something that can be a performance parameter that certain teams can use and other teams can't.
Yeah, well, it could certainly help make up for a less powerful engine and or better, more efficient, let you take advantage of better, more efficient aerodynamics that other teams haven't developed. And you've long been in favor of, and I have too, to allow the team to just use DRS as often as they like, or the drivers, when they're on the track. It was always very exciting and qualifying when they did that.
Yeah, and I feel that the reason that we lost unlimited DRS in qualifying was because of the advantage that Red Bull had suddenly learnt to gain. For example, them using DRS wide open through 130R in Suzuka. I think that was the nail in the coffin for unlimited DRS, because then it becomes a safety element. But we've kind of come full circle now. It's still a safety element, but they're reliant on the fact that the driver will disengage DRS if he feels that it is a safety issue. So, but yeah, my overarching want for DRS is to have it as a deployment tool where you have so many presses per race, and then it becomes a strategic tool that can be used to attack and defend. But I've listened to Charlie Whiting's explanations in some of the presses, and he's dead set against that style of DRS. So I don't see it being something that we'll see in the future, unfortunately.
Well, that's too bad. And speaking of too bad, how about we take a moment and talk about the midfield? Because, at least one of last year's darlings seems to suddenly be having not the greatest of seasons. And I thought you might have some insight on that.
I assume we're talking about the Indian force here, are we?
Yes. Yes, indeed.
Yes, unfortunately, fourth in the Constructors' Championship for the last two seasons, and they seem to have taken somewhat of a stroll back down the pack, unfortunately. They seem to be having problems with this car, problems that come from probably budget issues more than anything else. They've always been able to work exceptionally well with the small budget that they've got. But when that budget is stretched to the maximum and you don't get your payouts when you expect them from FOM because other teams veto them, Williams, then you're going to suffer, unfortunately. And that has an impact on development. So that veto by Williams could have effectively set Force India back by 6 to 12 weeks just purely because they can't get the funding to continue to develop the car in the way in that they need to continue. But I also feel that they might be having some of the issues that we've seen happen previously at the Cologne Tunnel. Toyota's great facility in Cologne, there's two tunnels there, which Force India and McLaren both use. McLaren have used, I think, since about 2012, maybe earlier than that. And Ferrari used to use when they were having problems with correlation in their own tunnel. But everybody that's gone to that facility seems to come up against these same stumbling blocks. They seem to, at some point, make gains, and then all of a sudden, something doesn't seem to work. So you have to question if there's perhaps cause and effect. But what I would say is that Force India, obviously, I expect to make a decent poke at next season because the regulation change again. They always seem to make a decent stab at a regulation change, and we're stripping some downforce back. So hopefully we'll see them rise again. But I think they'll struggle for the rest of this season, especially when you're up against the likes of Renault, who've made a big step forward, and obviously Sauber, who have made a leap forward and have a certain young Monegasque driver in one of the seats.
Yes, and the deal that they've done with Ferrari, I think for Sauber, has provided them with not only a modern power unit, not using a year-old one this year, but it seems to have brought a whole host of other legal, I would say, resources to the team that they had previously been lacking. And obviously, they had the people there to do the things once they had the things to be done with, is how it looks to me.
Yeah, I mean, I said as soon as I saw this particular car that I found it technically very interesting because of the way in which that they've approached the side pod design, because they haven't copied the low slung side impact support spars that some of the other teams have for this season that Ferrari pioneered in 2017. They've gone about it their own way. But they've gone about it in a very similar way to Ferrari, just leaving the spar in its sort of conventional position. And a lot of the performance this since 2017 has been unlocked by the way in which teams are designing their side pods, the leading edge of the floor and the barge boards, and the way all of those devices sort of interact with one another. And as I say, the Sauber has a very particular design that's quite interesting and jives very well with the new style Ferrari power unit. But on top of that, their development program has been pretty impressive this year as well. They've obviously sunk a lot of money into the project. And again, as you say, they've had assistance in terms of the way that they're getting parts from Ferrari. So now they're running a blown axle, which previously they weren't. And that's a part that they could have, in effect, have taken from the Ferrari stable because it comes as part of the front brakes assembly. And it's just those small areas where you think that, you know, some smart money has been put into these development areas to make the leap forward. As I say, I'm very impressed with where Sauber have managed to pull themselves up to this year.
Right. And that's going to be Cedric Vasseur, who was previously at Renault, right? And Lotus before?
He wasn't at Lotus. He moved over to Renault. He previously ran GP2 teams. But yeah, Fred Vasseur is obviously partly responsible for the success at Sauber. I think some of the machinations that have gone on there have happened prior to his arrival. But I think on top of that, he's been able to restructure things that are going on there and improve the way in which things are working. Clearly, there's obviously a lot of investment gone on when Lungbo bought into Sauber. They obviously bought in a lot of investment with them. And so, yeah, obviously this Ferrari/Alfa Romeo deal is quite significant. And Ferrari want to give the tools to Charles Leclerc in a way in which that he can then provide the performance out on track to prove the fact that he will inevitably become a Ferrari full-time driver. So yeah, it only makes sense for them to continue with this sort of this role. And you know, this opportunity that they have with Charles at the moment may obviously spread into another driver, and they become effectively the junior team to Ferrari. And as much as that we see Red Bull and Toro Rosso in that respect for drivers.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Yeah, and their Ferrari cousins are also doing reasonably well too. Although I think Sauber is making more out of what they have than Haas at the moment, because, and you might disagree with me and that's okay, but it always seems to come back to operational issues for them.
Yeah, unfortunately with Haas, I think we forget that they're such a young team, and they are going to make mistakes in that respect. They are a very close-knit team as well. They don't have the personnel that you would find at Sauber, for argument's sake. And they are spread across three different areas of development. So obviously they've got their US, their UK and their Italian bases. So there's a bit of a spread there. But yeah, Haas have kind of should have delivered more. They had such an exceptional start to the season in Australia, and they didn't capitalize on it because of a wheel nut issue that obviously befell both drivers at that time. But then we've had other instances where they've had really good performances and their drivers have had issues themselves. So I think there's been a case for Haas of throwing some of their championship points away, and they should be in a better position than they are. But for me personally, I feel that Sauber have made a much bigger leap forward than Haas have this year, just purely on the basis of the development that they've thrown at the car.
It's good to have money. It's better to have smart money. And that's what seems to be going on at Sauber. We've not really talked about McLaren or Williams. Dare we depress everybody by going there?
It would be two very depressing comments, wouldn't it? Unfortunately, we're seeing two giants of the sport descend down the grid. And unfortunately, Williams are the worst team on the grid at the moment. Fundamentally, their car is broken. that have some major issues going on with that car. I know myself and yourself, Matt, have discussed these in private, but there's some design flaws with that particular car. I don't see them being able to resolve them very quickly. And I can quite easily see Williams throwing in the towel on this season quite early and looking at development for 2019, especially with the regulatory changes that are about to come on board as well.
Okay, so here's a question for you. Given the nature of those changes, the way the front wing is changing and the way they're changing the aerodynamics, I remember at the start of these regulations, Williams ran what looked like to me, in all my ignorance, is a very, very, basically very slippery, fast car that could do very well on fast flowing circuits and was going to just be somewhere mid-pack in the rest. Do you think that the upcoming regulations and their success early on in the 2014 regulations might actually give them something to hang their hat on, or Williams fans to hang their hat on for next year? Or is it just really... was it really just like that beautiful Victorian house that has just gone to seed, Miss Havisham's, for lack of a better example?
Unfortunately, the problem that you've got is that the 2014 regulations and the 2017 regulations are drastically different, unfortunately, for Williams and Williams fans. The 2019 regulations, although they go backwards compared to this year and 2017, they are only a march backwards in terms of the fact that we're making changes to the front wing and the way in which the outwash works, and we're widening the rear wing, so we're adding more drag effectively, what is what we're saying to the car. But the barge boards, which is an area of huge performance at the moment and where a lot of the teams are making performance, has only been changed in as much as the height, which won't have a significant effect, if I'm honest. So, yeah, I don't see it as a huge march forward for Williams if they decide to build a super slippery car, because we're still going to see big downforce numbers on these cars next year, even with the sort of simplified front wing. It's just the way in which the car will work with those performance parameters.
Well, that's too bad. I had hoped with the simplification that they might be able to reach back into the file drawer and find something that had actually worked for them and use that as the basis for where they were going. But you're saying that's really not going to be the case.
No, and I don't fully believe that everything that's wrong with this particular car is related to aero. I think Williams are struggling to understand multiple facets of the car. It's not just the aerodynamic problems that they're suffering, like the ones they did in Silverstone. I think they've got problems in terms of the way in which the car works mechanically, the way the suspension works, the pitch angle, the way that the tyres interact with all of this. It's just, unfortunately, I think that this car is a little bit broken, and... as I say, I think they'll be throwing more resource at the 2019 car towards the end of this season than they will this car, because I think they know what's wrong. It's just that fixing it on this year is going to be problematic.
Yeah, and they do run into, even though they are a big, in everyone's mind, they're like a big top five team, but really, you know, they had a big bubble of money pass through, but they don't have the bus patent anymore. A lot of those sort of one-off investments have sort of gone away. So in a way, from a cash point of view, they are more resource limited than we're used to thinking of them as being. And maybe it's just difficult to come to grips with that and figure out how to be smart about how you're going to spend the money that you do have.
Yeah, I mean, the thing for Williams and what they'll be waiting to hang their hat on is the 2021 regulations. Because at that point, then we're looking at budget caps, which inevitably means that the big boys who spend the big bucks now can no longer spend the big bucks. I know there's going to end up being a glide path because they're never going to agree on what inevitably has been set as the cost cap right now, because otherwise we'll be laying off staff left, right and centre. But what you will see is a shrinking of the ability to be able to resource what the big teams have. So yeah, I think Williams will be looking at 2021 as their line in the sand where they may be able to make a big leap forward. I don't see them making a leap into the top four anytime soon, unfortunately.
Okay, let's move on to McLaren. Zach Brown finally came out and admitted what everybody has known for about the past 7 years, which is that McLaren has lost the shine. The glory is gone. And the rebuilding, when it happens, will be lengthy. And, you know, just looking at it, I have the sense, at least, that this had been a long time coming. Sort of this recognition of the fact that things have changed, and as a result, McLaren is going to have to change. But now that they're open about it, do you see them being able to make progress, or do you think it's going to be a long time in the wilderness for them?
I think that, again, we've talked about budget with both Force India and Williams already, and I think the thing that people seem to be forgetting about is the fact that McLaren's budget has shrunk over the years. So the resources that they once had available to them are now much smaller, which means that they have to work more effectively for that small budget. That, you know, we've seen that the car's sparse of sponsorships, for argument's sake, to have one of the most expensive drivers on their books. You know, the figures don't kind of add up to where they actually sit within the realms of Formula One at the moment, unfortunately. And yeah, I do think it's going to be a long process and a long road back for McLaren, unfortunately. And whilst they've made progress this year, they were extremely hindered by taking on board the Renault Power Unit for this season, purely because from a installation point of view, it's so drastically different from the Honda Power Unit, which obviously we've seen has started to make strides now, which is ironic, obviously, now that they've parted companies. But the problem for McLaren, again, is that they followed a very similar philosophy for the last few years to Red Bull. And Red Bull know the parameters of the Power Unit that they're operating now since 2014. They know how much cooling they can get on the car. And unfortunately, the McLaren is very similar in terms of the cooling parameters, but it obviously cannot work the Power Unit in the same way. So they're actually giving up performance from the Power Unit because they can't get the best from it. So they may actually be down on power compared to Red Bull and Renault in that respect because they can't operate at the upper limits. If you think about the temperature control of the Power Unit. So, yeah, there's a lot gone amiss at McLaren, unfortunately, from a technical point of view. I do see it being a long road back, and there's no easy fix. This car is well-balanced. They've already mentioned that, but it's just missing downforce. They've got some fundamental issues going on, and we've seen them in the last couple of races using prototype parts to try to understand how they can fix and resolve those problems going into next season. So they've been running a new front wing, new barge boards and floor and diffuser and all sorts of front brake ducts, all sorts of things, just to see how the flow will react differently with different parts on the car.
And we haven't mentioned Renault except by contrast, but it looks like to me that they are doing a fairly good job of managing their new investment. They seem to have made some strides with the occasional misstep thrown in there.
Yeah, well, the problem for Renault is that they bought into a team that they'd already previously owned. Obviously, they knew it very well. At Enstone. But the problem that they had is that under the previous ownership, let's just say that money became an issue, which obviously meant that the resources started to slide in the wrong direction. And now they've had to make changes in order to get those resources put back in place, which takes time and a lot of money. And they are starting to make inroads into getting performance back on the car. But the other thing that I've noted when Cyril Abitbol's talked about these sort of performance areas, and even Nick Chester, is that they have a relative, what they class as a relatively young environment. And some of these people haven't seen the sort of downforce loadings that we're used to in this era. So you have to go back to sort of 2006 to 2008 to see the kind of downforce that we're now seeing again in 2017 and 2018. And obviously these engineers hadn't worked in that phase. So although they can design the parts, they're not used to having the parts that can take the load. So they've had some of those issues. And one of their other issues is the way in which that the car reacts to mid to high speed corners and the way it turns in. I believe they're actually going to have a new front wing concept at the next Grand Prix in Germany to try and resolve some of these issues. So it'll be very interesting to see where they come out in terms of performance compared to where they've already been the rest of the season.
It will be interesting. I know they're wanting to be best of the rest for starters, but they alone among the midfield look like they're hooked up enough to maybe take a step towards that top tier of races. And I'll be very curious to see what they do for next year. I think that will be a big challenge for them.
Yeah, it'd be very interesting, especially with being then effectively, I know they are the works team, but without Red Bull in the fold, they then become the de facto works team. Nobody to hide behind. They are the lead chargers for Renault. Whereas currently you've got this strange situation where Red Bull are a semi-works team in effect, because Renault still want them to get good results, but they want the publicity that they weren't already getting. So it's a strange environment that you find them in. And for me, as I've said in the past, I always saw this Honda route for Red Bull based on the fact that they couldn't get a power unit anywhere else. So it was an inevitability that they would end up in this situation.
Hmm. So before we move on to the podium, is there any other business, anything else you want to bring up, and any other excitement we should be thinking about and looking at as we head to the next Grand Prix?
Well, there's one just small technical story that's starting to bubble up under the surface, and it's to do with wing mirrors again, because the FIA have decided that visibility for the drivers is paramount, and a lot of the accidents that are happening at the moment are caused by the fact that the drivers cannot see behind them. Now, who'd have thought that when you put the wing mirrors where they are and you widen the rear wing to the point where you can't see past the rear wing? But there we go. Anyway, so what it looks like is happening is that the FIA are going to produce some technical directives that will have to be instigated by Singapore. So we're going to see new mirror designs across the board, which is going to have quite an interesting impact, because a lot of the teams don't use mirrors for mirrors. They use them as aerodynamic devices, although that's obviously supposed to be a secondary function. That's not necessarily the case. And what the FIA are going to ask in these technical directives is that the reflective element of the wing mirror is pushed more outboard, which obviously then has an impact either on having much wider mirrors, or mirrors in a more outboard position, which, as I say, has an aerodynamic impact. So I think over the next few races, we're going to see some interesting free practice sort of visibility checks and new aero devices being used by the teams to cover this new technical directive.
That is a beautiful and fascinating thing for us to be watching out for. But I do have a much more fundamental and basic question, which is every car I've driven that's been built after about 2012 or 2013 has a camera built into it so that I can look forward and see what's directly behind me. Is there a reason, given the huge LED screen in the steering wheel now, that they've just not gone ahead and gone to a camera-mounted system, which would get rid of any usage of a wing mirror as any kind of aerodynamic device, and would give the driver literally the ability to see directly behind them, which they will never have with any wing mirror, no matter how well-designed it is currently?
I'd love to answer that question, Matt, and I've asked the question previously myself. I think it's primarily down to a technology bias. They want something that is always there, unless it gets knocked off, obviously, which wing mirrors rarely do, unless they vibrate off the car if you're a horse. So I think that's primarily what we're talking about. It's something that's a function that's always been there, and there's an adversity to change. And also, that those screens in the center of the steering wheel have so much information on them, so much for the drivers to absorb, that I think by having the rear view as another option, it may just be detrimental to the way in which that they operate the actual commands of the car. But that's not saying that there isn't another way of mounting it. We only have to look at the fact that Williams run a butterfly steering wheel and they have their LCD display on the cockpit dashboard rather than on the steering wheel. So, you know, there's always ways around these things. It's just down to the FIA to make the changes, I guess.
Yeah, well, instead of having an actual wing mirror that's reflective, why not just mount two screens there that show you what's directly behind you on one side and what's directly behind you on the other side?
Again, another plausible way of dealing with the problem, but we don't always deal with problems very effectively in Formula One because it's all very political. Just as I expect that these technical directives might get changed based upon certain opinions up and down the paddock on how much it's going to help or hinder their particular campaign going forward.
Okay, let's move on to the podium. I do love me a little bit of Carmen. Who for you has missed the apex?
Well, if we're talking about teams, then we're clearly talking about Williams, because unfortunately their car is not performing to the best of its capabilities. On a secondary function, I'd also say Williams have missed the apex in terms of not selecting Robert Kubica as one of their drivers. Just purely down to the fact of how much information he can possibly give them to improve their car. I'm not saying Sorokin and Lance Stroll aren't performing to the best of their abilities, but I do feel that perhaps having a more mature driver that understands setup in the way that Robert used to may obviously improve what the problems that they've got down at Williams.
Yeah, for me... I don't know. It's a tough one. I mean, really, you say Williams, and I'm thinking we should have like a Nader Award for that, because but to be fair, although they are absolutely at the bottom, they are performing about where we would have expected them to. I think the team that has missed the apex the most really has to be Haas, because they've just left so many points on the table again. And as much as I'm a fan and want them to do well, and I love it, you know, like they had the one brilliant race result, it just seems like every race you're just like, oh man, they really should have had all those extra points. And I just keep on waiting for them to mature as an organization to the point where they can really start being consistent in the way they're going to need to be to compete regularly for best of the rest, which I think is going to be the top of their structure. But that's the best they're going to be able to aim for at the moment. Wow. I spent a long time saying that. Who gets a pony for you?
Pony awards. I think I gave it to Red Bull last time. But I can never really look past Red Bull in terms of the pony award, because they're the ones who always seem to be moaning about everything. They're the ones in the strategy group who have to have a moan because something isn't going their way, and they want an Aston Martin power unit. Because they haven't got enough horsepower and so on and so forth. So, yeah, unfortunately, I'm going to pop the pony for Red Bull again.
Yes, honoris causa. It is a thing. They do make themselves a target that way. They are not shy about speaking up repeatedly and working the refs until they get exactly what it is they wanted. Kevlar sidewall tires, I'm talking about you. And your thing. What is your thing? Tell us your thing so we can get out of here. And thanks for sticking with us through the recording.
The thing of the start of this season so far for me is the Sauber C37 wielded by Charles Leclerc.
I think that is an excellent way for us to go out. So, Summers, tell us, where can we find you? What are you up to?
I am working at motorsport.com with the legend that is Giorgio Piola, utilizing his illustrations and listening to the many and brilliant stories that he has. You can find me on summersf1.co.uk, where you can also find your great content, Matt, coming directly from the New York E-Prix pit lane this weekend. So, yeah, they're the two best places to find us at the moment.
Yeah, I think I've already taken over 1,000 photographs, and some of them are actually probably interesting and not just like somebody's knee. As for me, I'm at MattPT55 on the internet, and by the time you hear this, probably I will be mostly done with my E-Prix coverage, but do check it out. It'll be on Summer's site. It'll be on Twitter and Instagram, at MattPT55. And remember, chicks dig heels, wounds cause scars, and glory is a fungible concept under certain philosophical precepts. This has been Missed Apex Podcast.
Oh, man.
I feel like my head's about to fall off.
Did you notice we didn't talk about tires?
I know we didn't talk about tires, but you know, I did talk about asphalt with Felix Rosenquist. I asked him because the, you saw the pictures I sent yesterday, but you saw how different those surfaces were on the track, and I asked him, he's like, oh yeah, we can definitely feel that.
I'm not surprised. It would have a different effect. I would imagine it has a different frequency.
We
feel that when we change tarmacs, when we're driving down a road, for argument's sake. I can feel a frequency change.
Sorry, I'm typing to Stevens to see.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.